Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, August 13th, 2025, and our friend Laith Maarouf from Beirut is back with us. Welcome back, Laith.
Great to be with you, Nima.
What's going on, Laith, in Lebanon? What is happening right now?
The foreign affairs minister of Iran, Larjani, has just arrived. It's important to understand that he refused to speak to the foreign affairs minister of Lebanon, who is from the Christian supremacist parties and has been working in the international arena against the resistance and Iran. So he did not receive an invitation from the foreign affairs minister. Instead, he received an invitation from the speaker of the house, Nabih Berri, the leader of the Amal movement. And he has been touring since the morning. At his arrival to the airport, there was thousands of people out in the streets, welcoming him with a convoy through the city. That was a kind of a show of force and support within the Lebanese population. And he met with both the president and the Speaker of the House. He's supposed to be meeting with the Prime Minister sometime soon, but he will not be meeting with the Foreign Affairs Minister of Lebanon, who made public statements or attempted to have the government refuse the arrival of the Foreign Affairs Minister of Iran. So there is a live press conference happening. I didn't have time to watch it, but as we're speaking, it's still happening, that press conference of Larjani.
I think what's happening, one of the main reasons of this visit on the part of the Supreme, he's the head of the Supreme Iranian National Security Council. And what's happening to Hezbollah? What's going on within Lebanon with Hezbollah? And why is that so much important for the Iranians that to come there to talk? What is the message, in your opinion, to the Lebanese government?
Yeah, well, last week, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, Nawaf Salam, at a cabinet meeting, changed the agenda abruptly and brought in a motion to get the military to write up a plan to disarm Hezbollah by the end of December this year. So this was not only the move was in violation of all parliamentary procedures, and you have now this man who was the chair of the International Court of Justice, meaning this man is supposed to know parliamentary procedures, Robert rules, or French parliamentary procedures that the Lebanese state follows, where you cannot change the agenda without two-thirds approval from the sitting body that you are bringing an agenda to. And there, all the Shia members of the cabinet withdrew. There was already two of them that were out on vacation, and then another two withdrew. So we had a very unconstitutional move by the Prime Minister. And since then, the country has now is on the edge. So the head of the military is having a fight, General Haykal, with the Prime Minister on this issue. We know and hear that within the military, both the military intelligence and the cadre are saying that this is an impossible situation, that this would lead to the dissolving of the military, either through a direct confrontation with Hezbollah, which would lead to their defeat, and or through mutiny within the ranks of the military. So this is a impossible situation that the Prime Minister put the country in. And now, of course, we are, Iran is trying to show the government, including the president of Lebanon, who has a different position than the Prime Minister in terms of their vision of what disarmament means, or the president used the words monopoly of weapons in the territory of Lebanon. This, the vision of the prime president could mean the absorption of Hezbollah into the military, how the popular mobilization units were in Iraq absorbed into the Iraqi military. On the other hand, what the prime minister is suggesting is a disarmament of Hezbollah instead and a destruction of its weapons that could be useful to the Lebanese military, because this is what actually the Israelis and the Americans want. They do not want a strong Lebanese military or the existence of a resistance in the country that could fill the gap if there is no strong military. And so the next few weeks are crucial to the country, and Iran sending Larjani, the head of their National Security Council, to Lebanon is a clear indication to the Lebanese state that Iran will be standing on the side of the resistance, or the ability of Lebanon to have a strong military that could replace that resistance.
You know, it's somehow when we had this government in Lebanon, everybody was talking about that may help Lebanon, but it doesn't seem that would be the case, because they're trying to make some sort of turmoil within the country going against Hezbollah. We know that the only force, they're so young, the government is so young that they don't have that much of experience, and they're trying to go against Hezbollah, which has a lot of leverage politically and militarily in Lebanon, in my opinion. But how can they somehow convince people in Lebanon that would be beneficial for Lebanon in a long run?
I don't think they'll be able to convince the Lebanese people. This is not about democracy, as we see. This is about colonialism, imperialism. And, no people in the region, in the whole region, have any democratic will allowed by the West for them. Okay, we know that the West is fine with bringing former founders of ISIS into power in Damascus if that suits them. And actually, that's what they want. They want to crush the will of the people to resist, and you need to bring butchers into power that are the U.S. House slave butchers kind, okay? So it's also important to note that, Salam, the current prime minister, his grandfather was a treasonous, collaborator who, before even the creation of the Zionist colony in Palestine, during the Ottoman rule in the 1920s, fabricated by bribing Ottoman record and land deed offices, defrauded the indigenous inhabitants of the Hula Valley, the panhandle that you see in Palestine sticking up, the Palestinian and the Lebanese villagers there, defrauded them of their land, and had a plan with the Zionists, before even the creation of the Zionist colony, to drain the marshlands and the Hula Lake, which was more north of the Galilee, Sea of Galilee. In the Hula Valley, there was a lake and a marshland. And he drained the land with the help of the Zionists and then sold it to them for what is worth 30 million pounds at the time. The grandfather of the current prime minister of Lebanon collaborated with the Zionists in the 1930s and sold them the Hula Valley that he stole from the indigenous population with the help of corrupt Ottoman record holders. So, and the uncle and the father of the current prime minister also collaborated with the Zionists, both in Haifa, where his uncle owned all these plots of land, and built a huge Art Deco kind of shopping mall in the heart of Haifa, and sold it to the Zionists again. Okay, so this is not something that is one generation or two generation or by chance that Nawaf Salam is collaborating with the Zionists. This is a multi-generation of land owners, you know, whatever you want to call them, I forgot the term that you would have for that, that have collaborated with the colonialists and the Zionists for a long time. So for Nawaf Salam, it's the chance for him to bring back this title of colonial administrator on behalf of the Zionists that went to his uncle's family. Okay, like the bloodline went from his grandfather, and then, you know, the Ottoman you know, administrative title went to his uncle instead of his father, and now he's fulfilling, bringing back that title to himself and his bloodline. So this is how it works. And of course, the Lebanese people can see what's happening in Syria. The vast majority of Christians, Alawis, Shia, Druze in Lebanon are arming themselves to the teeth and will not accept the disarmament of Hezbollah. And if there is a confrontation, this war, it's not going to be, quote unquote, a civil war, because it was never, you know, it will be collaborators of the Zionists killing their the citizens of Lebanon, not civil war. It will be an invasion by HTS and the Zionists at the same time. And this will trigger a war that will drag in Iraq, Syria, and Iran all at once. And we've already saw over the last 2 days, the Israelis claiming that drones hit their positions in the Golan Heights coming from the east, meaning from Iraq. So there's already signals that things could move differently this time. You know, we also even saw attacks on Erbil in Iraq, multiple drones hitting the Kurdistan, you know, collaborationist class and their military positions. So all of these are signals that a triggering of a war on Lebanon will mean, for the first time, an open war zone from Iran all the way to Palestine.
And not only that, Netanyahu is talking about he's going to attack Iran. Doesn't matter if the United States is going to help them or not. It seems if things go to that direction, there would be a decision on the part of these people who are supporting the movement against Hezbollah. We know that the new people in Syria, they're supporting, that they want, they're somehow collaborating to disarm Hezbollah. Saudi Arabia wants that. Turkey, it seems to me, they're silent, but it seems that this sort of silence somehow shows that they're literally, they're supporting what's going on. Who else is supporting that, the movement against Hezbollah, disarmament?
Oh, the Jordanian government, the Egyptians, all the Gulf countries. Turkey, I did mention that it is for the monopolization of weapons in the hands of the military. And of course, Europe is all saying the same thing. So the local vassals of the West and Western capitals are pushing for this. Look, I know it all of these things that the Zionists are doing and the West is doing may look illogical to all of us. You know, the Zionists are losing all these wars. The West didn't win any war in 30 years, what have you, you know. So, but when you start to understand that there is clear religious driver behind this, it's not only about money. It's not about oil only. It's not about trade only. It's not about dominance only. It's not about cultural dominance only. It's about actual messianic beliefs that are driving these leaders in the West and in Israel to do what they do. Netanyahu was interviewed yesterday by Channel 12, I-24, sorry, in the Zionist colony, and it was in English. And it was a very long interview. People should, if you want to understand what I'm talking about, watch this. he said that the Jewish people believe he is the one that's going to bring Eretz Israel. Okay, that he is on a divine, basically, quest, and that he's going to achieve it. And so, you know, if you only think of that this, what he's doing is about his survival as a political leader, or this is all about money and oil pipelines and this and that, you can't calculate correctly what's the next step that the Zionists or the West are doing. Truly, Netanyahu believes, and the Zionists behind them, believe that they're going to bring the Messiah. Truly, the Christian Zionist in control of London, Paris, Germany, you know, Berlin, Washington, Ottawa, truly these Christian Zionists believe that they will bring the Messiah back, okay? And that we are living those days, that Hagog and Magog will arise from Iran and China, okay? That these are the end days, and we need to have this slaughter, right? Even the Christian Zionists believe they're going to kill one-third of the Jews, convert the other third of the Jews, and one-third will go to hell, okay, and live the end days. This is truly what's driving these people. And now you have, of course, even somebody like Putin, who is coming back to orthodoxy, right? And the driver right now of what is Russian identity, this supposed savior of Christendom or Orthodox Christendom, right? And this itself is driving Russia also in its battle in Ukraine and or in Syria. Those are the things that and finally, we have the Shia and the Muslims in general that also have their own now driver of, you know, esotericism, thinking of end of days and the return of the Mahdi and all of that. These are real drivers of how these civilizations are moving now.
Leith, when Israel is talking about the greater Israel, here is what does that mean? You look at the map, you see, goes to Saudi Arabia, Iraq, comes to Iran's border, and, you know, most of Syria, just a little bit of Turkey, and goes to Egypt. It's unbelievable. I don't know these people who are somehow feeling there's some, because looking at Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Egypt, I don't know if they have any sort of logic in their mind, any sort of rationality in their behavior, or they don't care about what would happen, because look at what has happened to Syria. Israel was not bombing Syria. Syria, after all, had an army. You can argue that was weak and all of that, but there was no bombing of Syria. Israel destroyed everything after Assad was gone. They destroyed everything in Syria. And with Al-Jolani and his gang in Syria, they're prepared, even they want to tomorrow, this in an hour, to kill Al-Jolani, they can do that. You know, I don't know why the government in Turkey, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, doesn't see the threat. They sort of, because this is all about the security of the region. It's not just about making these people, they're trying to do the same in Lebanon. It's the same. Nothing more than that would come out of, nothing less than that would come out of that, the new policy in Lebanon. Because without Hezbollah, who's going to defend Lebanon?
Look, if we read history, we wouldn't be confused of why the decision makers in Jordan or Saudi are taking these decisions. And I encourage everybody to read the writings of John Philby. John Philby was the British agent from the India Intelligence Office of the UK that basically ran all of the operations of the UK intelligence in Asia and East Africa. And so John Philby was the original, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, if you want to say, that entered Arabia in the late 1800s and early 1900s and searched for agents that could work with the British against the Ottoman rule, control of the Hejaz and the east of Arabia. You know, if people don't even remember this, most people don't even know this, that, you know, Oman, for instance, was occupied by the Portuguese since the late 1700s, okay? And that, you know, the British came and replaced the Portuguese as the colonial rulers in those areas and in Aden and so forth in Yemen. So these are... This is a long-term history. John Philby, you know, has in his books the pictures of the Saud family leaders that they created, sitting down with the founders of the Zionist organization of the world before Israel existed, right? The Saud family received a salary, the leaders, from the British intelligence office in India, okay, up until the 1940s, late 40s, that until the discovery of oil in Saudi Arabia, the Saud family were poor desert dwellers that were receiving salary by head of how many, you know, and you can read about how. You know, this relationship, of course, is the same with the rulers of what now is called the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Qatar, which were all states fabricated in the 1960s and 70s by the British. They didn't exist before those countries. So, you know, to think suddenly the Saud family that has a 100-somewhat years of collaboration with the Zionists, including raiding Mecca and Medina, and you know, building up the Wahhabi cult to kill Muslim unity, and collaborate with the Zionists all the way, every cent, you know, every war that happened since the 1930s. You can even read in Philby's writings about how the Sauds spent all their money trying to defuse the great Palestinian revolt in 1932, okay? And send their agents to kill the leaders of the great Arab revolt, okay? So this is not a new thing. So understand these histories, and then you're not surprised that every Arabic, now Arabic leader, because they killed every Arabic leader or Muslim leader that tried to fight for his own people's sovereignty. Look, you know, in Philby's books, you can read about what they did to Pakistan, the Sauds with him specifically, right? And how they killed Bhutto and to bring in, you know, even there's a picture of the head of Bhutto between two Saudi swords after they chopped his head. Okay, this is a long history. And anyone that wants to put their hopes in some change in the Arab monarchs and or somebody like Erdogan is fooling themselves and fooling the masses. No, there's no solution but to overthrow these people and to and if you can't overthrow them, to burn their resources so they can't keep on spending them as they have spent them for over a century on the destruction of the Arab and Muslim peoples. That's what the wealth of the Gulf has been spent on. And pity the Arabic and Muslim peoples today, where now, after the fall of Damascus, there's not much Arabic or Muslim countries in the world that are not under control of Washington, D.C.
when we look at the defense budget of Saudi Arabia, Leith, it's much higher than what that of Iran, and it somehow feels for many people who are looking at the statistics and at the numbers of, they feel so that would mean something. It doesn't mean anything, you know. If Israel attacks Saudi Arabia, they're not going to be able to defend themselves. I don't see an army. None of these Arab states in the Persian Gulf are capable of defending themselves. Don't they really feel vulnerable when it comes to the sort of attacks? How is that a feeling for the people? I don't know how much do we know about the people, the public opinion in these countries. How do they feel about this?
Well, the latest surveys of the public in the Saudi Kingdom says 99% are against the existence of Israel, not against the genocide only in Gaza. And that, this is true in most of the Arabic countries and Muslim countries. There's no doubt in my mind that there's a huge difference between the rulers and the people in these countries. In fact, you can read from that meeting between Abdulaziz al-Saud and the envoy of Ben-Gurion in 1930, somewhat when they were trying to frustrate the Great Palestinian Revolt, how the Zionist, who was brought in by Philby, by the way, dressed up in the personal clothes of Abdulaziz al-Saud that sent it to Philby with him to dress up the Zionist envoy when he enters the palace, and so nobody can know that this is a Zionist. He was asked, why are you saying all these things that are pro the revolt and talking about liberation of Palestine to the masses? And Abdulaziz tells them, well, what do you want me to say to the people? That I am working with you? Do you want us, our rule to end? You want us to help you, right? So don't look at my words. This is what Abdulaziz is saying to the Zionist envoy. Don't listen to my words. Look at what I'm doing. He was plotting on killing Saudi citizens that went to Palestine in the 1930s to help in the liberation of Palestine from British rule. So this is what we live today. And I know the map that the Zionists put there of Eretz Israel looks daunting. Wow, they're going to occupy Saudi or Egypt. They don't need to. They already occupy Saudi and Egypt. The map doesn't need to change. They can now enter, as Philby did, by the way, John Philby, when the Saud army that he led entered Mecca, occupied it from the Hashemites, and pushed them out. John Philby got on the Ma'adhan, and you know the what do you call it? The towers on a mosque there, in English.
Tom.
Yeah,
the tomb,
the towers on top of a mosque where the prayer call comes from, the Ma'adhana in Arabic. The point is, he got on top of there, John Philby, and did the prayer, call to prayer. A Christian in Mecca on the day of his occupation. So look, there is right now Israelis actually walking inside Mecca. There was one last year that posted his own videos from inside the holy sites.
It's called Minaret? Minaret?
Yes, a minaret, yes.
Minaret,
so,
yeah.
So what I'm trying to say to you is that the map doesn't really need to change. What needs to change is the last countries that oppose Zionism need to be changed, their regime changes in them, and then the Zionists can walk from the river Nile to the river Euphrates. He's already walking to the river Nile and looting that country and living as king. Why does he need to change the Sisi regime? He doesn't need to. So the map doesn't need to change. What needs to change is the regimes in any country that oppose Zionism.
Yeah. Leith, I think the message from Iran to the government in Lebanon is so clear. They're sending, because Ali Larijani is not some regular messenger to the government in Lebanon. He's sending the leader of Iran is sending a solid message there, and because we know that Iran is the main supporter of Hezbollah because of what's going on in southern Lebanon, because what's going on in Gaza, they see that it would be so much important for Iran to support Hezbollah, and they're not going to back down on that. Never. I talk with them, many of them, they don't feel that they're going to, it's not possible. To what extent the government in Lebanon would continue this confrontation within the society in Lebanon, in your opinion?
I think house slaves will do anything that master asks them to. So, and given that there is the drive that the Zionists have and the support that the Americans have, look at what the Americans government just said about the six Palestinian journalists that were killed. They called them terrorists, the speaker on behalf of the government in front of the media. Called them like members of Hamas. This is speech patterns of somebody that doesn't give a damn and will continue in killing, mass killing in the region and mass destruction. So I think we're going to a war. The trigger could be that the government, the military refuses to disarm Hezbollah, and then the West invades, and Israel invades, and the HTS invades, and then everybody in the region is embroiled in this war. And definitely, Iran will not sit and watch and let Hezbollah be destroyed, or Lebanon be destroyed, or the Lebanese people being enslaved. There is not going to be any doubt in my mind that the minute a invasion force attempts to occupy Lebanon, that Iran will enter the war directly. That everybody should understand this. And this is, why I think we're going to see another at least year of war in the region. And there's going to be hundreds of thousands of victims above and beyond the 500,000, if not more, that already were killed inside Gaza. The number could go up to at least 2 million victims from Lebanon, Syria, other places in the region as this war continues and engulfs larger continuous territory. And at that end of that year that we're ahead of us, all of humanity is going to be put in a dead-end situation of either ending the Zionist colony and or we're going to be in a nuclear war. No two ways, a third way other than this possible ahead of us in the next year.
What's the argument on the part of HTS and Al-Jolani to join the fight against Hezbollah? We know what do they want, but what's the argument on their part, the official argument that they're trying to put out?
Well, the HTS Minister of Foreign Affairs, quote unquote, is now in Amman this morning, arrived in Amman, Jordan. And that signals, obviously, that the Jordanian intelligence is going to have a big role in whatever happens, not only in South Syria, as the discussion is about Suwaida right now, but also in a situation of a war in Lebanon. The Jordanian intelligence is second only to the Turkish intelligence in terms of its control of Wahhabi and Ikhwani assets around the world. And Amman is the second largest hub for movement for these Wahhabi death squads to be distributed around the world. Nobody, most people don't recognize this, but if some of your audience were aware at that time or have that memory, if everybody remembers when Snowden released his first batch of leaks about the PRISM, intelligence gathering system, and it was clear on the map, the global map, that Jordan is the most surveilled place on Earth. And that's because of how much of the mercenaries have to be moved there, and mercenaries have to be watched themselves all the time. This is above and beyond that. It's on the border with Palestine. Otherwise, Lebanon would be a higher on the surveillance list if the issue is only opposition to the Zionist colony. It's more about how the movement of Wahhabi death squads around the world is hub through Amman and Turkey also. So I think HTS is also, we hear the talk about HTS trying to make a deal with Russia to occupy the area in the south of Syria and return with its military posts and military police, convoys in the region. And that's another indicator that there's a deal with Israel to have Russia kind of become a buffer zone between the Israelis and resistance in the area. Not about HTS, it's about the locals in Qunaitra and Dar'a area and Suwaida area, who are all from patriotic backgrounds, and as we see, that's why they're being punished. How do you control them? Well, you bring in the Russians to do that, and then it's not HTS and it's not the Israelis that will have the headache of subduing these populations.
Leith, what is the official mindset in considering the Hezbollah's policy? We know that the Iranian Ali Larijani has met with Sheikh Naim Qasem and he talked with him. What is the name? Do we know what they talk about? What was the main topics that they talk about? It was about the future of Hezbollah. It's about the relation, the way that Hezbollah is trying to somehow manage the situation, the talks between itself and the government in Lebanon. What were the main issues, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have yet any, or if there is, I haven't read them, the public statements about that visit. But I could imagine that, Iran asked whatever Hezbollah wants, they will be there for it. Remember, this relationship between Hezbollah and Iran is symbiotic, and it's not one higher than the other. So Iran would wait for Hezbollah's direction to follow on the situation, and most probably they discussed those possibilities, how Hezbollah sees things going to move in Lebanon. And of course, there's multiple possible outcomes, and those outcomes have possible rollouts to them, and they must have exchanged that information and to see how the possibilities will play out. And so that's not going to be definitely discussed in any public statement, and Larijani is going to go back directly with this information to the National Security Council of Iran, and they will have to devise their plans of readiness to any possible confrontation in the region, depending on how things play out. So this meeting most probably focused on that. And I think anything else in terms of what Iran should do as public statements or how it should have its foreign policies play out in the region, that's discussed with less senior politicians in Iran and or within Hezbollah. The main thing that the discussion probably between these two leaders was is about the various you know, possible outcomes of what's happening.
Netanyahu is talking about capturing all of Gaza and the West Bank. So if that's the plan on their part, who's going to resist that? It's going to be Hezbollah, Yemen, and the resistance. They're trying to disarm Hamas. They're trying to disarm Hezbollah. And with the case of Houthis, they're far away from there. They can use their missiles to hit Israel. But it seems that Israel is trying to somehow manage the situation in the region, then go after other parties, call it Iran and Yemen. So how do you think it's all about Abraham Accords? It's all about, because on the other hand, we see that Donald Trump is talking about let's start the new talks between the Arab states and Israel. You see Azerbaijan is sending that they want to join the Accords, and I don't know what would be the outcome for Azerbaijan, but it's a huge, what's going on, Leif, going to from Syria, going to Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Central Asia. It's a line of jihadis, Wahhabis, and all of this. It seems that this sort of movement, they're trying to do something. I don't know if the region and what's going on is obvious or somehow for the people in Lebanon, what do they understand about the whole thing, the whole situation in the region?
Okay, there's a lot of things that you brought up there. The first thing is a few hours ago, the Yemeni armed forces announced that they fired 6 drones on 4 Israeli military installations. So Yemen is continuing its war against the Zionists, and we haven't seen any ships pass through the Red Sea in a long time that are going to the Zionist colony and or from companies that go to the Zionist colony. So there's a huge drop in all trade through the Suez Canal, and that's a huge achievement. The other thing that you brought up here, the issue of the Abraham Accords and Azerbaijan. I mean, let's go back to Abdelaziz bin Saud's words. Don't care about anything is said. Look at what is happening. Abraham Accords, with all these already collaborationist regimes, sign them or not, what is it going to make a difference to Israel? Is it going to increase its trade? It's already at its maximum with these regimes. Is it going to increase its stature with the population? No, the population is still going to hate them, with or without open collaboration of their leaders. And Azerbaijan, what is Israel going to gain if Azerbaijan signs a treaty openly? Azerbaijan is giving all its gas and its oil to the Zionist colony to kill all the Arabic and Muslim people. Azerbaijan opened its airspace to the attacks on Iran and most probably was involved in the assassination of President Raisi. Okay, so what difference does it make? Nothing on the material. So let's forget all the talk. And let's look at the important things that you mentioned, the corridors for movement of imperial forces that include these Wahhabi death squads. And and this is where Russia made huge mistakes, and it's going to have to now regret them, where it did not enforce itself in Armenia and let the small minority of collaborationists in Armenia sell more of Armenia's territory to the historical enemies of the Armenian people, the Turkish people, who conducted, with the help of Kurds, then the Armenian genocide. This is how humiliating oh, Armenian people, what happened to you, that your own people do this? And so with Russia losing, because it didn't fight hard enough to maintain Armenia, now Erdogan, NATO, are going to have this corridor connecting to Azerbaijan, which will make it much easier for the neo-Turkic imperialism that Erdogan dreams about. He doesn't dream about returning. People make a mistake thinking that he wants to return the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is not allowed for him because the majority of the lands that the Ottoman Empire controlled were Arabs, and the Arabs are supposed to be the slaves of the Israelis. Okay? And so he's supposed to look inwards towards Central Asia, to the origin of the Turkish people who came as invaders, as Mongol Turkic hordes, okay, to look east and see how can he expand through Azerbaijan to the Caspian Sea, to the other side, where Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan are, which is the soft belly of Russia and China. So now the Russians are going to have to deal with an opposite migration of the Wahhabi death squads that were coming from Central Asia through Turkey to the Arabic world and Africa, mass killing them. Now they're going to go back the other way and destabilize the soft belly of Russia. And that all, again, falls on Russia's mistakes. Right? Russia's mistakes in Armenia and Russia's mistakes in Syria that kept the hordes, the mostly Central Asian hordes of Wahhabis, kept them in the battlefield in Syria. Now they're free to be distributed by the CIA back into Central Asia.
I think the Turkish government doesn't understand that the sword that they're using against the people in the region is not theirs. After all, they're going to take it, and it's unbelievable. No, because when you look at the Wahhabi and Salafi movement, do you see? I know the Turkish culture. It doesn't have anything to do with these people. And when it comes to the support from the government in Turkey going to these people, how can you imagine that? How can you legitimize that in the eyes of the government, in the eyes of the people, somehow convincing people that the support that we give the Al-Jolani and these sort of movement, they're talking about Turkic people, but they're not Turkic people. This is a movement, it's Salafi movement, in the radical movement. Is that recognizable for the people, in your opinion, in Turkey?
I think it is recognizable. One thing in Turkey is that up until now, there hasn't been a total erasure of history. Okay. I mean, look, I just brought up Philby, and most people don't even know who he is. Okay, the guy is buried in Mecca. Okay. So I know that Turkish people still remember what happened during the World War I and the Armenian genocide and the Assyrian genocide and the Greek genocide, and they remember what the fascists did, and they, you know, there is still publication and discussion and so forth. Their minds haven't been erased or totally detached from history yet. That doesn't mean that I can expect any revolt. They're yet to rise, those movements in Turkey, and as we see, any former threat to the rule of Erdogan doesn't exist, even from the Kurds now, who laid down their weapons because their master said so in Tel Aviv. So I don't see any change coming in Turkey either anytime soon. We need to see leaders and new movements arise, and this is the age for that. You know, with all the sad news that we are reading and depressing situation that we see in Syria and Palestine and in Lebanon and what have you, the field is open right now, even with maybe even more so with the losses, with the huge losses of you know, visionaries like Sinwar or Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. It's now the land has been fertilized with the blood of righteous marchers, and this land now is ripe to birth new flowers, a new spring of ideas, and this is because, you know, I'm talking about Philippi from 140 years ago. Well, there is no Philippi right now. It's hidden anymore. Everything is right in the open now. The collaboration of the Zionists, the Wahhabis, the Ikhwanis, the Nazis, the Hindutva, all together. It's all open, right? There's no more hidden issues. So the people are ready. Their minds have been cleared of 140 years of propaganda that weighed down, that allowed confusion, like leading to people fighting against Syria, for instance, and so on. That's gone now. It's all cleared from everybody's mind. And now there's a moment that I expect, inshallah, of rebirth in all these nations of new thought, and not only the Arabic people, all around Africa, all around Latin America. The hegemony of Western domination of ideas, of historical record, is collapsing. Nobody believes now any history that is presented by somebody coming from the West. Everybody's looking for the alternative histories, and it's already there. And so I see bright future if it's not all ended with a nuclear Holocaust.
Yeah. I think for all of us, it's so clear, before wrapping up, to understand, just look at Gaza. They're starving people, and they're talking about that Hamas is doing that. They're blaming each and everything that they're doing on Hamas, which we know that is not the case. And they're going to do this to Lebanon if the people should understand that. It has happened to Syria. And it's all about Israel and greater Israel, nothing. I think you're talking about the Saudi Arabia being in the hand of Israelis somehow politically, and the militarily they're not capable of doing anything. We know that. But after all, they want to capture Lebanon. They want to capture all these territories.
But by the way, I forgot to say when we were talking about Gaza that just a few hours ago, right, the Israelis announced yesterday that they're going to begin the invasion of Gaza City, and lo and behold, at least 12 officers killed in the attempted beginnings of the invasion. You know, this is this morning, right? And it's not all regular soldiers, officers. So it's a complex trap that was set up for the command and control advancing vehicles into the Gaza City. The Islamic Jihad released a statement last night saying they destroyed 56 armored vehicles over just the last month. Mm-hmm. That's like tanks and APCs. And there was a video of a complex attack by Hamas released also this morning, showing three different armored vehicles being destroyed. This is the Israelis attempting to go into Gaza will lead to their slaughter. And there's a big fight between the commander-in-chief of the military and the minister of defense and Netanyahu, because the guy is like, you know, you're going to kill my soldiers. Their Israeli media today is going crazy there about this internal fight. And there's even a possibility of removal of the commander-in-chief of the military because of his refusal to take the orders from Netanyahu and the Minister of Defense, Katz. And finally, I want to say there was a demonstration of retired Israeli Air Force pilots, hundreds of them, outside the Ministry of Defense, calling for an end of the war, and because, number one, they're worried about the consequences to their legally to them as Air Force pilots for war crimes, and for releasing the Israeli captives inside Gaza. So these are all clear indications that things are not going well. And if Israel goes into a war with Lebanon, it's not going to go well. If they lose 12 officers in one day in trying to enter Gaza City, imagine they're trying to enter Lebanese villages. What's going to happen? No, people shouldn't fear the coming war. It's going to come, not because it's logical. It's going to come because Netanyahu and the Western elite really believe they are chosen peoples and are bringing Armageddon. Now we have to, our citizens of the West need to understand this and move against their own governments and elites to stop us from rolling into a nuclear world war.
I don't see Israel attacking Lebanon, Hezbollah, because last time you remember what has happened to them. They were somehow begging for a ceasefire. And the situation in Gaza, I think the capturing all of Gaza is somehow delusional. They're not going to get it. They're not going to. Thank you so much, Leith, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Have a nice day, Nima. See you soon.
See you soon. Bye-bye.